and the Poem from the Library of Congress. This series is called Favorite Poets. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest today is Rita Dove, former Poet Laureate of the United States. She is now a special consultant to the Poet Laureate of the United States for the library's 200th anniversary, its bicentennial. And as we move toward the millennium, we'll be asking her advice. Here is Rita in her own voice with an opening poem.
Maple Valley Branch Library, 1967. For a 15-year-old, there was plenty to do. Browse the magazines, slip into the adult section to see what vast tristesse was born of rush hour traffic, décolletés, and the plague of too much money. There was so much to discover: how to lay out a road, the language of flowers, and the place of women in the tribe of Mosht. There were equations elegant as a French twist, fractal geometries unwinding maple leaf. I could follow, step by step, the slow disclosure of a pineapple jello mold, or take the path of Harold's purple crayon through the bedroom window and on to a lavender spill of stars. Oh, I could walk any aisle and smell wisdom, put a hand out to touch the rough curve of bound leather, the harsh parchment of dreams. As for the improbable librarian with her salt and paprika upsweep, her British accent and sweater clip, mom of a kid I knew from school, I'd go up to her desk and ask for help on bareback rodeo or binary codes, phonics, gestalt theory, lead poisoning in the late Roman Empire, the play of light in Dutch Renaissance painting. I would claim to be researching pre-Columbian pottery or Chinese footbinding, but all I wanted to know was, tell me what you've read that keeps that half-smile afloat above the collar of your impeccable blouse. So I read Gone with the Wind because it was big, and haiku because they were small. I studied history for its rhapsody of dates, lingered over Cubist art for the way it showed all sides of a guitar at once. All the time in the world was there, and sometimes all the world on a single page. As much as I could hold on my plastic card's imprint, I took, greedily, 6 books, 6 volumes of bliss, the stuff we humans are made of, words and sighs and silence, ink and whips, Brahma and cosine, corsets and poetry and blood sugar levels. I carried it home, past 5 blocks of aluminum siding and the old garage where, on its boarded-up doors, someone had scrawled, "I can eat an elephant if I take small bites." "Yes," I said, to no one in particular, "that's what I'm going to do."
The voice of Rita Dove. So if you want to be America's greatest lyric poet, you know now how to do it. There's also another poem you have curled up reading, eating olives, I think, and crackers.
Oh, I had a different food for every book.
And your parents were very demanding of your excellence. You've been very plain speaking about that, and I bet they take all the credit now. That all you have to do is make her do flashcards, make her talk about herself at the dinner table every night, whether she wants to or not, and she can grow up to be the Poet Laureate. They had no idea at that time, did they?
They had no idea, but they did instill in all of us, and I have a brother and 2 sisters, that we could do anything we wanted to do as long as we prepared ourselves and believed in ourselves enough to do it. So though they did raise us strictly, I mean, we did have to read every book from the library before we could get new ones out and things like that. It was done with love. I never felt that they were unjustly, you know, sentencing us, let's say, to the books. But sometimes I thought, well, we could play a little bit more, but the books were fascinating, too.
Rita Dove served as Poet Laureate of the United States and consultant in poetry to the Library of Congress from 1993 to 1995. She was born in Akron, Ohio. She's published 6 poetry collections, among them Thomas and Beulah, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 1987. I cannot believe it just seems like yesterday. She is also the author of the novel Through the Ivory Gate and the drama The Darker Face of the Earth, which premiered at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in 96 and then was at the Kennedy Center. I saw it and has been in London since then. Her song cycle, Seven for Luck, with music by John Williams, was performed with the Boston Symphony Orchestra at Tanglewood. And there are many other things she does which we will disclose to you one by one. But the best thing she does is write poetry for us, and she is the most gracious spirit in the library. As a special consultant, I know you don't have official duties except to be wise and knowing and probably support Robert when he, as a safety net. But we have to talk about this wonderful place as a repository for 2,000 tapes of poetry since 1946.
Yes.
The repository of the most works of literature in the world. Mm-hmm. What can we say beyond that? I mean,
it does speak for itself, but I think to impress upon people how magical it is to hear a poem in the poet's voice, and to also be able to hear a poet talk about their work. We don't know what Emily Dickinson sounded like. I would give anything to be able to hear her read one of her poems, because the human voice moving through the words is what infuses poetry with its life. It's not just black marks on paper, but there is a human utterance behind it. To have that here, in this marvelous archive, is a treasure. It's an international treasure.
And they say the voice is the breath of God, so surely that conveys the line on the page. Well, we are going to hear that voice today. It is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and I have before me the most recent book of Rita's, and it is On the Bus with Rosa Parks. Now, would you set up the book a little bit, because it does many things before it gets to Rosa Parks' mm-hmm. story. And I'd like to know just when she captured your imagination, I guess at the same time she captured all of ours, but when you wanted to make her the subject of your own work. Mm.
Well, you are correct, Grace, in saying that she captured my imagination at the same time she captured all of our imagination, that this, let's say, ordinary woman could change history by a simple act, and that she did it with such grace and with such containment, such presence. When that happened, I was very young when she did sit down and not get up from that bus seat in Montgomery, Alabama, 1955. But I grew up with the example of Rosa Parks, the fact that you never know when you're going to be called upon to stand up for what you believe in, no matter what. And that was that readiness, that sense of being ready, mm-hmm. and also being willing to say, yes, I will put my soul and my spirit and my reputation, everything else on the line for something that I believe in, something that I grew up with, and the notion that no one was a nobody, nobody was insignificant. You never knew when suddenly you would be called upon to make that significant move. It changes the way you look at the world. It changes the way you do your homework, you know.
Well, it's interesting because in your own life, you were not touched by ugliness directly. You do speak about your father with a master's degree in chemistry and a brilliant man in his own right, who at the time the world was not ready to employ him, and he was an elevator operator in a menial task and did it without rancor. Mm-hmm. Finally, you say that somebody made a breakthrough and was able to reinstate him to his proper position as a chemist, the first black chemist for the rubber industry.
Yes,
or was it just for Goodyear?
It was for the rubber industry in this country.
But the years before that happened, I think of him riding up and down that elevator without anger. But you were touched in a way, but never ruined.
Exactly. My parents did not tell me about this, that incident in my father's phase of my father's life, until I was well into college, and he had been a research chemist and promoted countless times. So I grew up believing that everything was possible if you did your best. And I asked my father and my mother, why didn't you tell me this? And they said, we didn't want you to be discouraged. I said, you didn't need that burden then. And so they told me when I was old enough to be able to take it. And and to have confidence in myself.
And the other allusion I recall from your work and your writings is you were an honored scholar at Tuskegee. And
yes.
During the day, you were revered for who you were. At night, you went home and you looked in your rear view mirror, however. And therefore, indirectly, the world of Rosa Parks was always waiting in you to be written.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. I mean, when I was at Tuskegee, I lived in the neighboring town. And it was true that I would go from Tuskegee and the atmosphere of support and incredible hunger for learning, and then drive home and drive past a few fraternity houses, let's say, that you had to watch. You had to watch to make sure your tires weren't slashed and things like that. But I grew up in the world of Rosa Parks, knowing that still discrimination could happen, could rear its head. And so I grew up with this icon. When I began to think about the poetry and the idea of doing a cycle on Rosa Parks, that occurred after I had met her. And I met her several times, and this one particular time, my daughter leaned over to me. We were in a bus. We were at a conference. Rosa Parks was also taking part in the conference, and we were being ferried to one more conference site. You know, conferences sometimes are spread out over different buildings. We got on the bus, and Aviva, my daughter, leaned over and said, "We're on the bus with Rosa Parks." And there was the title for the sequence, and I knew it in that instance. It was a combination of things, not just the notion of Rosa Parks, but also being on the bus with her, that we're always on the bus with her. We're always at the moment of decision. And having met her, and realizing that it was, she still knew how important it was for her to serve as an icon, let's say, to be present, to remind people. That was very important to me. She was such an unassuming and gentle and loving person who was still as eager about life as she was back in 1955.
There is a new museum and library, Rosa Parks Library. I hope that your book is on a nice little pedestal in the middle of it. Do we think it will be?
I hope so.
Yeah. Let us hear something from this.
Mm-hmm. Let me read you a poem from the sequence on the bus with Rosa Parks. The book really goes from personal histories and various individuals who are trying to find their place in the world and how they can best serve it. And the book culminates with this group of poems about Rosa Parks and about about the idea of being on the bus with her. So I will read for you a poem that is about that moment when Rosa Parks refuses to get up. It's called simply Rosa.
Hmm.
How she sat there. The time right, inside a place so wrong, it was ready. That trim name with its dream of a bench to rest on, her sensible coat.
Mm-hmm.
Doing nothing was the doing, the clean flame of her gaze carved by a camera flash. How she stood up when they bent down to retrieve her purse. That courtesy. I was after a poem that seemed as quiet and as strong as we perceive Rosa Parks to be when we see her in that famous photograph. That was one of the things that made her such a viable test case for the segregation in public transport, that broke the back of segregation in public transport in Alabama, because she was able to exude this strength and this serenity, even when they were arresting her, even when she went into court. When she went into court and she walked up, and there were crowds of people there, and she walked into the courtroom, someone yelled out of the crowd, "Oh, she's so sweet, they got the wrong one now." And I love that mix of that, the fact that she's so sweet, and at the same time, the person recognized they picked the wrong person to pick on. So the poem had to be small, but at the same time contained.
I'm so glad you said that, because I got it. I'll tell you why. I say, Rita has this vast knowledge of history, and it's throughout all of her work. But how do you take a gigantic episode and make a crystal out of it? I mean, how do you approach it? What angle do you take? It's too big to write about. And so I thought, you know, when I saw the book and hadn't opened it yet, I thought, how is she going to get this little chip? And darned if you didn't explain it. It is to reduce it to the crystal, which she is, which makes her eternal.
Yes.
But to get the poem that matches that, that's the remarkable thing, to have gotten into that state of mind.
This was a very hard poem to write. It was one of the last ones that I wrote, in fact, and I kept whittling it down and whittling it down. At the very last minute, in fact, I took out four lines. And I remember my editor saying, when she heard I was doing that, she goes, oh, no, don't do that. And then after I did it, she goes, I like those lines, but I see why you did it. So it was necessary.
Did Rosa Parks read this book?
I have sent it to Rosa Parks. I don't know if she's read it yet.
I was sort of scared to ask. I think she probably would not be a person that would be extravagant in discussing what she thinks and feels.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
But the fact that it's written, it will never be unwritten. Thank you for that. May we have one more from that cycle?
Sure. Let's see. Which one shall we do? Let me read a poem that is less about Rosa Parks and more about the notion of being on the bus, in the sense of being with Movement for Change and being committed to change. It's called Freedom Ride, and just to set the poem up, it's a kind of a, almost like a fantasy of those quintessential freedom rides from the 60s where people went down from the north into the south to integrate things. White people, black people, who really could have just sat home, you know, and not done anything, but instead they decided to go down into the south and to see if they could break the back of this segregation and this discrimination. Freedom Ride. As if, after High Street and the left turn onto Exchange, the view would veer unto some place fresh, Curaçao, or a mosque adrift on a milk-fed pond. But there's just more cloud cover, and germy air condensing on the tinted glass, and the little houses with their fearful patches of yard rushing into the flames. Pull the cord a stop too soon, and you'll find yourself walking a gauntlet of stairs. Daydream, and you'll wake up in the stale dark of a cinema, Dallas playing its mistake over and over until even that sad reel won't stay stuck. There's still Bobby and Malcolm and Memphis, at every corner the same scorched brick, darkened windows. Make no mistake, there's fire back where you came from, too. Pick any stop. You can ride into the afternoon singing with strangers, or rush home to the scotch you've been pouring all day. But where you sit is where you'll be when the fire hits.
Hmm. Rita Dove was a presidential scholar. She was named one of the 100 best high school graduates in the United States, and she graduated summa cum laude from Miami University in Ohio. She attended Universitat Tübingen. For an Italian, that's not too bad.
No.
And that was in Germany as a Fulbright. She received her Master of Fine Arts at the University of Iowa. And her most recent book is On the Bus with Rosa Parks. Of this book, I have to give a couple of remarks, because Rita will not praise herself. But it was said that her laser glance exposes and cauterizes its subjects in disturbing ways. That means it pierces and heals at the same time. And another critic said, Dove has been extending the boundaries of her art while also endeavoring to recover the past, be it that of European literary tradition or African American history and culture. She has created fresh configurations of the traditional and experimental, the historical and the contemporary. And this is very true. You've broken ground with Thomas and Beulah in your the way, with your participles, honey, with your way that you just broke apart language and put it like beautiful beads in fragments in a new way, I think, which changed American letters forevermore. So you've done many things. You've done straight-ahead writing, and I have before me a book called Rita Dove, The Poet's World, and in this are two very important essays, because in addition to writing plays and poems and stories and novels, she does write essays. I would like to talk about them just a moment in their essence, because the first one was Stepping Out.
Yes.
And would you give us then the context for that thinking about the poet stepping out in the world?
That lecture, which was called Stepping Out, addresses the challenge, I think, that poets today have to actually step out in the world and be in the world, as well as write about the world. And first in the essay, I also talk about how we think of our world and whether we think of our world as stepping out the front door or going out of the back door and looking at everything out in the back. But I also contend, and I do believe it is a problem, it's getting better, but I do contend that most American poets tend to look through the windows at the world rather than actually stepping out in the street and seeing what the neighborhood is like and getting engaged with the neighborhood. In other words, we tend to write about things, but not to get messy. And I think that even means messy in terms of our technique, in terms of a poem that's expansive, that's more Walt Whitman than say Wallace Stevens.
And you say it's the poets it's the windows we choose to look out of. I thought
yes.
That was remarkable.
Mm-hmm, yes, because you can choose to look out a window that gives you a good view. You can choose to look out a window on the second floor, which is a little bit safer than the ones on the first floor. You could choose to peek through the curtains, or you can choose to actually open the window. There are all these different ways to do that. But you can also choose to walk outside sometimes, and then you can come back and write about it. But I think that my challenge was that we needed to not think that the poetry was somehow separate from living, that the art is separate from life. I think they're inextricably bound together.
As you've proved in your own life, and also in that essay, was the poem A Sense of Place. You did then cross over to the idea of porch, door, window, mm-hmm. but also that place metaphorically influences the poem, too. Was that the same essay? I think
yes,
so.
Yes, that was the same one.
And you talked about the building of the house.
Yes, because one of my favorite books is The Poetics of Space by Gaston Bachelard, in which he talks about space and how our spirit and our imagination is inspired by space. And he has these marvelous titles like Shelves or Closets or The Cabin in the Wood. And so I talk also about what our notion of space is, and use the house as a metaphor for the human imagination, whether you go into the attic or whether you descend to the cellar, and what floor do you reside on most? You know, do you stay in the bedroom, you know, or do you actually get out into the parlor and entertain people?
And then moving, your closing lecture, the year you were laureate, was A Handful of Inwardness. Mm-hmm. And in that, you talked about, I actually think you wrote that in France.
I wrote quite a bit of it in France,
yeah,
yes.
In a house with a spider.
Very big spider.
And you, as we all know, you sleep all, except when you're teaching and mothering, you sleep all day and write mm-hmm. all night. And so there you were. I just had a picture of you writing in this house, and you said you couldn't do it for longer than 2 weeks or you would have gone bonkers. But what was your thesis for that essay?
Well, that essay took the other side, and to say that just because you walk out in the street, you step out into the world, does not mean that you don't have a handful of inwardness that you take with you. In other words, you need both to be a writer. You need to be able to live fully, deeply, and intensely. But you also need to be able to maintain or to nurture the inwardness necessary to write the poems, to meditate on the condition. The premise for that, or the setting for that lecture, let's say, was a 2-week period that I had spent in a crumbling stone house in a small village in France, and I don't know French, and so my husband and I were literally cut off. We had our own handful of inwardness there. It was necessary to finish a book of poems, but also it made me realize that you do need both. The problem with, I think, all art is that you need the quiet and the inwardness in order to make it happen, but you also need the bubbling up from the well. You need the source. You need the babble of voices. You need the music in the streets in order to get your inspiration. It's that going back and forth, the transitions, which I think make some people think that writers are a little bit nuts.
No, those are what are evidenced in your poems, and that's what gives it the full-bodiedness. What was the book you were trying to finish that week?
I was finishing the book Mother Love.
Oh.
Yes, which
really?
Is...
Well, let's move to that then.
Okay. Yes, this is a book which is based upon the Demeter and Persephone myth, mothers, the classic Greek mother and daughter story. My daughter, at the time that I was working on this book, was going through those early, you know, prepubescent and pubescent stages. So, in a sense, I was also experiencing farewells every day to her as she grew up and began to venture out into the world. It's a book of sonnets mostly, and it goes in and out. Sometimes there's a poem that's about the Greek myth exactly, and there are others which depart from that. But it is that eternal cycle of mother and daughter, and I needed to be in this place very quietly to finish the book. Let's see what I could read from here. Let me read one of the early poems. This is the moment when, as you remember, Persephone wanders away from her girlfriends to pick a flower, a narcissus actually, and it's because she's separated from the group that she gets abducted by Hades, the god of the underworld, who then takes her down and makes her his bride. This is from Persephone's point of view. The Narcissus Flower. I remember my foot in its frivolous slipper, a frightened bird. Not the earth unzipped, but the way I could see my own fingers and hear myself scream as the blossom incinerated. And though nothing could chasten the plunge, this man adamant as a knife easing into the humblest crevice, I found myself at the center of a calm so pure it was hate. The mystery is, you can eat fear before fear eats you. You can live beyond dying and become a queen whom nothing surprises.
I love the way you can make a declaration inside of a lyric poem. Not everyone can do that. And incorporate it. You can tell a little lesson. Give a little philosophical principle, you know, and that is, usually it sticks out like a lump, but not there. This is a seamless one. I'd like another from that book.
Okay.
We are at the Library of Congress with Rita Dove.
Let me read a slightly longer one, if that's all right, which is a series of sonnets. There are about five of them that are...
Would you describe the sonnet?
The sonnet is a 14-line poem, traditionally a love poem, though it does not have to be, with a rhyme scheme. It's usually an iambic pentameter, and it has there are varying rhyme schemes that you can have for a sonnet, the Petrarchan sonnet, which has 8 lines of kind of introduction, explication, and then a 6-line conclusion.
You're good.
Didn't know I had to do this today. Or the Shakespearean sonnet, which ends in a couplet, a concluding couplet. I'm a lot freer with my sonnets. They do rhyme, but they rhyme kind of sometimes slant. But I did want them because they are love poems. And this is a book of the love between mother and daughter and the love that binds them and separates them. In this poem, which is called The Bistro Sticks, we have a scene which is more contemporary. A brief explication, just to say that when Persephone finally comes, is allowed to rejoin her mother, all of the gods get together and convince Hades to let her go. It turns out she has eaten a few pomegranate seeds while she was in the underworld. And because she ate something from the underworld, it meant she could never entirely leave it, which is why we have 6 months of winter and 6 months of summer, because when she's in the underworld, her mother grieves for her. So this is a contemporary setting where the mother is coming to see her daughter. The hell is Paris, in this case. I don't think of Paris as hell, but I think that if a mother were trying to convince her daughter to leave a lover that she thinks is truly no good for her, then it would be hell to her. The mother is thinking, and they're meeting in a restaurant called the Bistro Styx.